Want to bring on the show right now something that we've been promoting for at least for all week, and ever since we got the initial indication that this gentleman was going to be booked. We've been promoting it since then. Just something really, really unique to bring all of you tonight, and something, a viewpoint and insight that nobody else is going to have for you other than this gentleman. Bill Roggio from the site BillRoggio.com, BillRoggio.com. The site is called The Fourth Rail, and Bill is a columnist. He is a military blogger, and he has gone over and done some embed journalism in Afghanistan, in Iraq, a couple of different times, and just returned this past week from a trip over to Iraq, and specifically out in the field in Anbar province. So we're very grateful to be able to have him on. This is the kind of opportunity to really find out what's happening that most of the rest of us never get to do. And we're very, very happy to be able to bring this to you tonight. So, Bill, welcome to the program this evening.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for the kind introduction. I appreciate it.
Well, we're very grateful to have you on, and grateful for your safe return, and I guess that's the kind of thing that can never be taken for granted when you go over there. I mean, I know you've been in the military, and you're used to facing some danger, but I know you just can't take that kind of thing for granted. So, and what are your thoughts for yourself out there in the field? You still with us, Bill? Okay, I think we lost Bill. Nathan is still on line one, I believe, right, Nathan? All right, we'll get them back on the line here. Much to get to as we resume the segment momentarily here in terms of this being a very pivotal time, of course, in the involvement over there. With this troop surge that is underway, the 21,500 troops on their way to Baghdad, a very critical, I think, make or break point in the war at this point in time. So very much to be able to get to. Again, we've been promoting this all week with Bill since we've known the specific time of the interview, and even longer since he had first consented to be on. Bill was unable to be on our debut show because he was over in Iraq at the time and had agreed to come on tonight on the heels of his return, and I think we've got him back now. Bill, you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Not sure what happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. Again, your thoughts on going over there. Again, how much peril do you feel like you're in? Obviously, you're with the best military in the world out there, but you're in some dangerous situations. What's the degree of danger in your own mind?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the hardest things one of the greatest difficulties I have explaining my experiences, you know, I think what everyone thinks Iraq is on a daily basis is based on what they see on the television. You see bombings, you see, you know, you hear two servicemen, three servicemen killed today in Iraq. And they take that to mean that, you know, Iraq is a very large country over the size of California. And they think that, you know, that fighting is occurring in every place, in every single city and town in Iraq, every single day, and it's not really that. I mean, combat war, and particularly in an insurgency, is I would, you know, if you look at it, the time of the day, it's 23 hours and 50 minutes of boredom with maybe 10 minutes of excitement interspersed throughout the day, and that's not even in your area of operations. So I've done 3.5 months out of the last 14 months I've been in combat zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, some things have happened around me, but I've yet to see full contact combat in that amount of time. And I make it an effort to be out on the streets, so either in vehicles or on foot patrols with the Iraqi military or the U.S. military every day. I mean, I trust them. I trust my safety with them. And having been a soldier myself in the past, I hope that I know what I'm looking for and have enough sense to get out of the way if the shooting actually starts.
Well, Bill, as the first big war, if you will, of the 21st century here, we keep hearing all the time about how things are different in so many different ways, not least of which is the fact that I believe as you and I were communicating, I think I even might have gotten an email from you when you were still over there. What's the procedure? Are you able to, and you've been updating your blog constantly when you were there, are you able to log on at the military bases or what's your procedure for that?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, my last embed in December, I was on wireless internet in Fallujah, commercial wireless internet while embedded with the Iraqi army and American troops. I was able to pick up Wi-Fi. Typically, most places you go to, even when I'm out with the military transition teams, and if your readers don't or your listeners don't know what this is, they're basically small teams of about 15 Marine or Army embedded with an entire battalion, about 800 Iraqi troops. So they have their own little, you know, living quarters there. I could typically log in onto their internet there, so I'll do my writing and then log in and check my email, which is, you know, that's how we communicated, and update my website. I try to update daily. And if not, I can pick myself up a little satellite uplink that I could hook in with an Ethernet cable into my computer. It's quite expensive, but you can do it and get online. So, you know, it's a modern war. It's a digital war in the sense that, you know, I can go on the battlefield and be out in the middle of the desert and still communicate via email and update the website. And we have to remember that the enemy can do the same as well. They're using technologies like Google Earth and email and other things, you know, Google Earth to get maps and email to send hidden messages and a whole bunch of other techniques as well. So, you know, this is the face of modern warfare and reporting and modern warfare as well.
It is amazing that the changes that we're seeing here with this, no question about it. Now, but before we get into some of the nitty-gritty of what you've seen there and some of really the kind of micro-level questions that we would have for you, one of our panelists who's on the phone, Nathan Noy, I know he's got a question for you on more of like a macro-type level, philosophically about some of the difficulties that we may be under. So I'd be very interested in hearing him pose the question and getting your thoughts on it. Nate?
Absolutely, Rick. You got me there?
I got you. Yeah. Great to hear
okay.
you.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Here's the question. I'm a historian, and John Locke wrote the Second Treatise of Government, the document that our founding fathers utilized to write our Constitution. And in that, he said that you cannot impose a government on people that don't ask for it. So, long term, according to John Locke, who again is the person behind our Constitution, his theory would be that we're never going to be successful there because here we are trying to impose a government, and the Iraqis in general are not asking for that form of government. Do you believe that, you know, that theory holds weight, and do you think we'll be successful long term if they really don't want us there?
Well, let's go back to the revolution or the post-revolutionary period here. We had a very deep split within our country between the, you know, the patriotic Americans and the loyalists that still wanted to give their loyalty to the crown. Did we try and force this form of government on the loyalists? I mean, how long did it take us to successfully put together, go from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution? It was, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 11 years for us to actually create and ratify our Constitution. The Iraqi people showed up to vote in numbers for their Constitution and for their form of government. Do I think that they understand fully what democracy is? Well, yes and no. I think they do understand, but they have a lot of problems to work out with their political system, with their political leaders. Obviously, there's some conflicts with, you know, the more radical Islamist leaders and democracy. But these are things that the Iraqi people, the Iraqi government, and their political parties have to work out. And I have to say, I mean, they show up for their parliament. They're passing laws. They're attempting to do things. They're not doing it efficiently. There's a lot of infighting. But ultimately, what I do see when I go out there, and this is why I like to go and embed with the actual troops, we hear a lot of people say the Iraqis won't fight for their government, they won't fight for their country, they won't fight for their freedom. Well, what I see when I go on the battlefield and embed at the micro level is I see guys that sign up, enlist, that understand the nature of the enemy, they fight the enemy, you know, and they get killed and take casualties at four times the rate as U.S. forces do, and they often do this without getting paid for it because of some serious problems within the Ministry of the Interior and Defense. So ultimately, I do believe that the democracy is compatible in Iraq. It's just going to be a long and bloody fight, and we have to stay it out.
Well, what about the difference, though? I mean, if we look at what the loyalists did, you know, their whole support network was the British Empire, which once we won that revolution, they withdrew. They were gone. We didn't have insurgency here in America when we were trying to, you know, form a new government. And obviously, the people with the real power in our country wanted that form of government. I mean, it seems like there's a clear distinction here in Iraq that there's people with a lot of weapons, a lot of power, a lot of hate for America that don't want any part of us. So, I mean, do you still think, when you're saying, you know, you're not giving me a time frame, but it seems like that's rooted in their upbringing, you know, the jihadists and everything else. I just, you know, worried with that kind of power, that's not the same kind of balance we had here in America.
Analogy that I made isn't perfect, is nowhere near perfect at all. And yes, it's the jihadist ideology, Al-Qaeda's involvement in Iraq, Iran's involvement in Iraq, Syria's involvement in Iraq, and, you know, allowing the, you know, this goes back to having, okay, so the British in after the Revolutionary War didn't interfere greatly in American internal affairs. You know, had they have, would we have been in a different situation? That's what we're seeing inside Iraq to this day. I mean, the Ba'athist element of the insurgency isn't strong because it's happening from internally. It's happening from the outside. They have a bastion in Syria. Al-Qaeda is funneling a lot of money and fighters into Iraq. Iran is funneling fighters and money and expertise to all players in this to keep the violence roiling in Iraq. So, you know, I think that we have to look at the external players as well when we look at this equation.
Well, Bill, I think your point there transitions very nicely to what we're going to get into more on the micro level in terms of what you're seeing out there with, again, not just this trip, but the previous trips that you've made. And I've read through very comprehensively a lot of your reporting on there, and you've been very prolific in what you've put up on the site there. So there have been a lot of different things to go through, but you seem to make the point here that in your time out there in the field, specifically with the snake eaters this time, the military trainers, that you seem to be seeing, if I'm reading this correctly, some progress out of the Iraqis and some steps forward after many things that have gone wrong previously?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, let's step back. A year, maybe 14 months ago, I was embedded with a Marine unit, and what they did at this time was pair, a Marine platoon with an Iraqi platoon, you know, 30 soldiers, put them out in these little forward operating bases, and they would patrol together, live together, eat together, you know, do everything together. Now we have this military transition team philosophy where they put a small team into a large Iraqi unit, and what I'm seeing the Iraqis do is they're owning their area of operations. They're going out every day patrolling, building their intelligence networks. They look a lot better as far as, you know, capable as soldiers. I have never seen any violation of any, you know, human rights violations or abuse of detainees whenever someone's stopped on the streets. I've seen a very professional-looking military that has some very serious problems when it comes to pay issues and logistics and, you know, the things that would make this an actual an army independent of American support.
Now, you have noted, Bill, and I think rightfully so in your reports, again, the mistakes made catastrophic in some instances. That's my words, not yours. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But as far as the things that led us to this point, allowing the Iraqi army to disintegrate and fade back into the population back in 2003 after the initial stage of the war. But you seem to be saying, if I'm reading this correctly here, that you don't think that it's irretrievable at this point, which is interesting because that's where a lot of the American people are at. And there's a lot of people like myself who are just so discouraged about what's going on who would really like to believe this. But can you really give us a sense of if it is or is not irretrievable at this point in terms of stabilizing the country, keeping the daily bombings and kidnappings and everything like that at least down to a minimal level?
Yeah, you are correct. I do not believe that any of the problems, the mistakes that we've made, while serious, none of these problems can't be fixed. I mean, if we want to draw another analogy to Vietnam, it took us quite some time to defeat the Viet Cong insurgency, which we did, you know, I think 6 to 7 years after, you know, after we really started getting involved there, and then eventually, you know, it became a war against North Korea. It takes time, you know, to go through, so we still have a lot of work to do on that stage. I mean, the insurgency itself, the Sunni element of the insurgency has been politically defeated. They don't have a political plan. They've lost the support of the tribes. The tribes are actually, I've seen them putting together these local militias that go out and hunt down insurgents. They provide intelligence against these guys. And once we make these inroads, and we are starting to seriously make these inroads in Anbar province, and now they're saying they're going to do a similar situation in Diyala province, another Sunni insurgency, an al-Qaeda bastion. It's very important. One of the things that we really need to clamp down on, and this is what I think is encouraging about what I'm seeing with this, with this new plan for Iraq, is they got to get a lid on the Shia death squads, because what that has done, and al-Qaeda has been very clever. Zakari said this in, I believe, late 2003, early 2004, that what his plan was to incite a civil war, a Sunni versus Shia civil war. And by destroying the Al-Askariya Mosque in Samarra last December, he created that. He created the opening for the Shia and the Sunni to go at it directly. And the death squads, we were on the cusp of getting a large element of that Sunni insurgency to quit. They've been exhausted by the fight against the Americans, despite, what you read in the news. We're not the only ones that are taking casualties in this war. The Sunni insurgents are taking serious casualties, have been and still are. I'm sorry to go long on this here. It's such a complicated question. But so if we can get those Sunni, get that chunk of Sunni insurgents, because they're not going to lay down their arms as long as there's Shia death squads out there. You wouldn't do this and I wouldn't do this. So once that we can get that violence down, and then it's just this al-Qaeda suicide bombing type thing that's going on, and not the Shia death squads going out and rounding up people, then what you're going to see is that that element of the Sunni insurgency, a large portion of it is going to give up. So another portion of that's going to go over to al-Qaeda. That'll allow us to focus in our efforts, and yes, it can be done, but to me, what I see, our biggest weakness in this war is just political will. You cannot win an insurgency in 3 years or 4 years, not one of this magnitude. Average life of an insurgency is 9 years, and what they are trying to do is erode our political will via our media. And I think our media is, while I understand their need to, report on, it's just the reporting lacks context, and it gives you an image that I explained earlier, where you think that this is happening everywhere in Iraq, and there is absolutely no success. One of the things I see by going out there, and I've been out and been to Iraq 3 times in the last year, is I see that there is a lot of good that's being done out there. I see the Iraqi people coming up and giving Americans and Iraqis intelligence, seeing them develop an intelligence network. I see all of these things happening, and it's a very positive. I see them fighting for their own freedom and for the security of their nation, and those are very positive things that, we cannot give up on.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear, Bill. But something I'm wondering also, and we've talked a lot about the elements that are in Iraq. We're starting to hear a little bit more coverage recently, especially with this talk about going after Iranian agents in the country. And you've done some writing about this on your website. Speak about the externalities here in terms of the Iranian agents that are over there. We haven't heard as much about the Syrians, but that there's got to be some of those. Al-Qaeda being an international organization, and of course you had that excellent State of the Jihad 2006 on your website as well here. Speak to some of the things flowing in from around the world that are complicating this for us.
Including Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, Saudi Arabia is up to it. I'll start with Saudi Arabia. Up to the old game of allowing its foreign or its extremists to bleed out of the country. If they go away and fight somewhere else, they did this during Afghanistan, they won't be a problem. Well, the Saudis play that game, as well as they're concerned about their own, safety. And it's difficult to get a handle on what goes on in Saudi Arabia. That's quite a schizophrenic country. But, so they basically allow their fighters, and then you have the Saudi Golden Chain, which finances much of al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Golden Chain is al-Qaeda's, its coffers, its source of finances. They like to see the deaths of Americans and the deaths of Shia, so you have the money sliding in from there. So Syria serves as a Ba'athist stronghold. All of all the Ba'athists have moved into Syria, and a lot of these Ba'athists have sort of joined up with al-Qaeda or become allies with al-Qaeda in Iraq. They have a lot of money, billions of dollars of Saddam Hussein's money flows from there as well. Iran has been running agents. I saw a number of up to 30 of an Iraqi general, I believe, estimated over 30,000 Iranian agents. I think that number might be quite high, and maybe it's 3,000. If you play the typical Arab or Middle East equation, you know, divide by 10. But they have a significant number of agents. We've been arresting them. They've been selling weapons and providing resources to not only to Sadr's Mahdi Army, but to elements of the Badr Corp, which is another Shia militia. They've been selling weapons to Ansar al-Sunna, which is a Islamist terrorist organization that has pledged loyalty to Osama bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and other Sunni insurgent groups as well, you know, providing mines and other sophisticated weapons to kill Americans. Their interest is I believe what the Iranian interest is to have Iraq balkanize and form into a Sunni, a Shia, and a Kurdish state, so it believes that it can exert more control over over a Shia state. So it just, the continuing violence, it certainly serves an Iranian need in Iran's equations here, as well as to force the U.S. to suffer defeat in the Middle East. That would be a huge black eye on us, and would lead to the ascendancy of Iran in the region if they can cause a U.S. defeat. Those are the three main players, and then of course you have Al-Qaeda Central, you know, which is feeding Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and you know, going, you know, sending its foreign fighters. We've had fighters killed from Afghanistan, Syria, Algeria, all over the Middle East, and as well as in the Western world, have been killed in fighting in Iraq. And you know, one of the big criticisms of the war is that, well, we've created terrorists there. And I would say it's both. You know, yes, Iraq is an engine for jihad as well as it's also with the, you know, the flypaper theory. We've killed a lot of senior, you know, 10, 15-year veterans of Al-Qaeda, mid-level and senior-level commanders. Omar al-Farouk was a senior Al-Qaeda leader who escaped from Bagram Prison in Afghanistan in 2005, I believe it was. The British wound up killing him in Basra late 2006. So, you know, Al-Qaeda Global has a vested interest in seeing the United States lose in Iraq as well.
Well, Bill, you've anticipated my next question, which is kind of an unhappy one for me to have to ask here. But from my point of view, from what I'm seeing, and I just want to get your thoughts on this too, it seems to me that with what's happening over there, that it in many ways is the best thing that could ever be happening for Iran, for North Korea, for a lot of the other major players in this world that want to see harm come to us in terms of our blood and our treasure. Continuously going into Iraq, in terms of at least the perception that, whether depending on how much reality there is to it, the perception that we are bogged down there. How much is our deterrent factor really suffering right about now? Because the reality is, we may have to go somewhere else and do something else here before this is all done in Iraq. And how compromised are we, if at all?
Well, I would agree with that only if we're willing to give in Iraq. Yes, if we do decide to withdraw, and withdraw as a failure without stabilizing the Iraqi government, then yes, Iran, North Korea, all of our Al-Qaeda, all of our enemies have won a great victory by proving that America is the paper tiger, and I guarantee it, we could expect more attacks on American soil on the soil of our allies. Look, we're doing some things finally. This is my biggest criticism of the administration. On September 12, 2001, we should have increased the size of the U.S. military. I've always said by 5 divisions, about 100,000, whatever that number you want to pick. But it was very obvious that we were going to be fighting in multiple wars in the Middle East and be forward deployed, you know, in this current war. Well, finally in 2006, you know, Secretary Gates, end of the year, beginning of this year, has decided to increase the size of the U.S. military by 92,000. Raise several more divisions, and we're actually, they're creating these combat, these brigade combat team. So with that, yes, that will give us the ability to sustain our current level of deployment, as well as have a reserve. We still have a large military. We have a 2 million man military, a huge guard and reserve force. So if there is a critical war that we do need to fight elsewhere. It's hard to imagine what that may be. I mean, if you would ask me, I would probably say it might be Pakistan if all things go real bad. But the Indians have quite a large army and have a vested interest in the security instability of Pakistan as well, so we have a chance there to play allies. I mean, you know, I'd say absent an open conflict with China, there's nothing really that's going to devote our attention that would require, you know, a full shift of forces from Iraq to elsewhere. So, you know, getting back to the point is, you know, our greatest weakness in war, in this war, is our willingness to fight. We've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. We've taken somewhere around 3,500 to 4,000 casualties in the entire war itself. And when you compare these numbers to past wars, it's just absolutely ridiculous to look at this and say that we have, you know, created a bloodbath for our troops.
Rick, if I can jump in with a quick question. Bill, do you think a massive troop surge, say another 100,000 troops, would that escalate the completion of our mission there? I mean, what do you think it's going to take?
Yeah, this surge that's currently going on, and I always, and I said this, and I've seen a lot of people write this since, is I don't think what's important isn't the number of troops, it's just that how we decide to fight this war. Are we going to decide to take on the Mahdi army? However, is it going to be serious political consideration, or are we going to fight them head on? Are we going to actually deal, you know, stop what's called the catch and release program, where we detain insurgents but they're let go because they don't have, you know, the full, you know, bounds of evidence that we would use in a U.S. courtroom? Well, we're fighting an insurgency. You cannot use, you know, a legal system, you know, that's designed for a peacetime government. So, you know, I always think that if we change our rules of engagement, if we pick a strategy and fight it to the fullest, the number of troops, that isn't as important as taking your strategy and implementing it. That is what's key. Now, that being said, would 100 troops help things in Iraq? The military and intelligence folks that I talk to say that anywhere from 30 to 50,000 is the number I get. Would really improve the security situation, would allow us to address, to deal with the army as well as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in take Ramadi, the city of Anbar City, Ramadi, head on, where there's some pockets, although I'm kind of skeptical of that because I'm seeing the improvement in that city, it leaps and bounds over the last several months. But so people that I talk to that I believe are very intelligent on this situation say that a surge of 30 to 50,000 troops would be more than fine. We picked the number of estimated about 22,000. Is that enough? We're going to find out. But again, I think it really goes back to, are we going to do the thing, make the changes that we need to make in order to get this thing going? That's more important.
We're speaking with Bill Roggio, BillRoggio.com. And, Bill, we appreciate your time here this evening. If I may, I think we've got three more questions we'd like to ask. I don't want to impose on you, but this is going so well here. My man Chris Galloway's got a question for you here, first of all.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing tonight?
Great. How are you, Chris?
Great. It's great stuff you're bringing us.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it a great deal. I did want to touch on Rick's comment about deterrence. I think the American military deterrence is still intact, in the sense that if you are a two-bit dictator like Kim in North Korea, or you're Iran, we've proven the ability to go in and topple those types of regimes. Now, obviously, we're struggling with occupation. I think somehow inherently, democracies as occupiers is always going to be something that's going to be difficult to accomplish. But as far as a deterrent for other nations that may want to wreak havoc on the international scene, I think we've at least, you know, granted we may be in some degree bogged down, but we've at least shown the ability to go in and topple other governing structures, other dictators. So I think that I would disagree with Rick a little bit. I think that deterrence is still sort of in place. From a strict, you know, military strike, you know, standpoint. But my question for you is, with respect to Syria, I'm wondering, do you think that we've maybe missed an opportunity to get involved, get the Syrians involved there, especially with respect to, since they're, you know, the current leader of Syria was, you know, raised and educated in England, speaks English, he's a doctor. Very fluent in, you know, the Western ways, very comfortable with that. Obviously, he has his own issues in terms of the Baathists and his country and all the old guard that were surrounding his father that give, you know, sort of give him his power. But at the same time, do you think that we, at any point, we can potentially have an ally in him with respect to this Middle East situation?
First, let me say that I do agree with you about the deterrence value. Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya, after the invasion of Iraq, basically that's why he turned over his weapons. He actually had a very comprehensive WMD program that he divulged to the U.S. and British, and he was quoted was saying to the Italian ambassador, the president of Italy, that, the prime minister, that I saw what happened in Iraq, and I didn't want that to be me. Back to Syria, it's a really good question. I mean, and we certainly are. It's only all we can do is speculate here. There's always been a lot of hope that Bashar al-Assad would, be the enlightened Syrian despot, and that we could play with him. After 9/11, Syria apparently cooperated with us on some detentions and arrested some Islamists, and it seemed like there might be some rapprochement going on there between the West and Syria, or the United States and Syria. After the invasion of Iraq, I think that personally, and I really don't have anything to base this on other than conversations with sources and from reading and from studying the situation. I don't think that he's a very effective leader, for one, and two, I think that the hardline elements within his regime really pulled the strings of power in Syria. We saw this with the events in Libya with the in Lebanon with the events of the assassinations and whatnot. Syria is too closely tied to Iran. Iran provides billions of dollars in aid to the Syrians. They've signed a strategic pact and whatnot. My understanding is that we made some overtures to Syria, which were, we basically got lip service on, yes, we want to be America's allies, but when it came down to it, their interests in Iraq were which is odd. I mean, considering that the two Ba'athist parties were at odds, the Syrian and Iraqi Ba'athist parties were at odds, but Syria does not want to see the United States succeed in Iraq when it comes down to it. So I don't believe that, despite his Western education, that Assad had any intentions of helping us. It would have undermined his political power base in Syria.
Hey, Bill, this is Burrell Jackson. I have one question regarding what I consider a conundrum of America's military forces being put in the middle of this sectarian violence in Iraq. On one hand, you have President al-Maliki, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Sure.
Who President Bush says he supports, and whom National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley is skeptical of, and they're not sure if he's the right man to do the job. But we're putting our forces there to put down these militias and these gangs, in particular the ones controlled by Muqtada al-Sadr. But at the same time, from what I'm understanding, al-Maliki's government is being supported and propped up by the Shiite militias. I mean, are we going to put them down and destroy them and eliminate them, or are we going to bring them to the table to negotiate some type of political settlement? I mean, it appears to me we're in a catch-22 situation. What do you think about that?
Well, Maliki has said that he's going to crack down on the militias this time around. He's said it in the past, but what we've seen over the last, actually even before they started talking about this new strategy, over 600 Mahdi Army, that's Muqtada al-Sadr's fighters, the Mahdi Army the fighters were arrested, and I believe we captured somewhere around 15 senior leaders since mid-December. So they have been and we've been continually conducting operations against the Mahdi Army. Maliki's in a difficult situation, and I have it from a very good source that he was actually threatened by Sadr. I don't believe that he's a real ally of Sadr as much as he's being intimidated by him. And this source had some very good information, and I believe it's correct that, that he and his family were threatened. Maliki, was a compromise candidate after Jafari, who was the previous prime minister, was kicked out. And so he got the support of all of the United Iraqi Alliance So to just say that he was Sauter's candidate is I don't believe is completely accurate. I think what we've seen, and people get that have that perception because he's been very weak against taking action against the Mahdi army, but he's vowed to crack down on him. We've seen it. What we're seeing now, and I think the Mahdi army believes it. They're, you know, we're seeing reports of their leaders are starting to flee to Iran. They've been told to lay low. They've been told not to confront the Americans and the Iraqis. And now we got to remember, again, we always look at this. I think this is one of our mistakes in the West. We see how this negatively affects us. And this situation even goes the same way with Iran. Iran has the upper hand because they're running agents in with us. Well, Iran has a lot to lose in Iraq. Well, so does the Mahdi army and Sauter has a lot to lose by not fighting this battle against the government, you know, against the reestablishing control in Baghdad. If they lay low and the violence is reduced, which is the goal of this security plan, or one of the goals, and then, you know, the government is seen as legitimate, the need for militias is not there it starts to decline over time, and, you know, people have greater faith in the security forces. If they come out and now and start killing again, you know, 6 months or 1 year later, That's not a very good. Doesn't reflect well on them in the eyes of the people. And also, if they don't oppose, if they don't stand up and fight against this, then the people are going to start to think that they're ineffective. I mean, in the Middle East, we have to understand that there's this sort of this over macho idea of, you know, they have to, you know, you stand and fight if you're threatened and whatnot. And, you know, if they back down from this fight, they lose face, basically. So, you know, we're not the only ones. The Iraqi government isn't the only ones in a bad situation when dealing with this new security plan and dealing with the issues of confrontation or non-confrontation. The militias have a lot to lose by not acting.
Bill, last question we got for you, a little bit of a two-parter here in terms of where we go from here, not just in Iraq, but the worldwide struggle that we have against the jihadists. Again, you had the very excellent State of the Jihad report up on your site at the end of December. Curious about whether you think that it was a net gain or a net loss last year when you look at Chechnya. I think you said in Somalia were among the pluses in terms of how we did overall against Al-Qaeda in 06, and also in terms of means of addressing that. It's conventional wisdom in some democratic circles, which makes me kind of dubious to begin with, that we should expand the special forces. I've heard the argument, and it seems compelling to me, it would just water down the special forces if we just said we're going to set this target number and expand it to there. So in terms of where we're at and what we can do about it, what are some of your thoughts?
Yeah, as far as where we are, as it was 2006, a net gain or net loss, I'd probably, and I'm usually an optimist on these things, I would say 2006, Somalia, were it not for the Christmas offensive by the Ethiopian army, would have been a net loss. Chechnya, you know, was certainly a net gain because of, we killed some very senior Al-Qaeda leaders in Chechnya, and the majority of the fighters basically accepted amnesty. In Iraq, I think overall, you know, while there's been good progress with the Iraqi military, it certainly was a setback. We've seen some good progress in the Philippines. People don't even realize we're fighting Al-Qaeda and Jemaah Islamiyah, an Al-Qaeda satellite organization in the Philippines, but they've dismantled much of Jemaah Islamiyah's organization. We finally seem to have the Philippine government at least fighting against this insurgency's Islamist insurgency in some of the theaters within the Philippines. But most concerning, I mean, Afghanistan and Pakistan, I always say you can't look at the two without, you can't discuss one country without discussing the other. You have a nebulous border between the two countries. And I think we've made great progress in Afghanistan, but what we have is basically the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have taken over large segments of western Pakistan. They've established training camps and bases of operations. They're sorting thousands of Taliban fighters into Afghanistan, and we're killing them in droves, but it's really setting back the reconstruction phase of the Afghanistan operations in southern and eastern Afghanistan, and that really, you know, starts to erode the will of the people that are expecting roads and public services, just basic public services. So you know, when I look at it from that perspective, that is a major loss. Pakistan is a nuclear-armed state. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, you know, have the potential, while I think it's a slim one, they certainly have the potential of taking over a nuclear-armed state, so it's very concerning what's happening there. As far as what we need to do, I mean, in as far as continuing the fight, you know, we need to continue to cultivate local allies. What we did with the Ethiopians was very significant. You know, we the Ethiopian army served as the ground forces in conjunction with the transitional federal government forces in Somalia against what was called the Al-Qaeda-backed Islamic courts. Basically, it was the Taliban in East Africa. They went in and wiped them out. But, you know, we have to follow through with the reconstruction phase. We have to fund this new government. We have to take, you know, what we're doing in the Philippines by arming and training the Philippine forces to, you know, give them the capabilities to fight. I mean, this is like local insurgencies on a global scale. That's what we're fighting here with a core Al-Qaeda group that is training and arming and funding suicide attacks on a global basis as well. They use base camps in the Philippines or in Somalia or in Chechnya in order to conduct these attacks. Would increasing special forces help? I mean, you know, the problem is your special forces are elite groups, and there's quite a high bar set for the selection process. Based on what I saw with the military transition, police transition teams in Iraq, you know, regular soldiers can go in and do these jobs if given the right resources and given the right training. You know, we can augment special forces with active duty troops to do some of these missions. You know, in a place like the Philippines, you know, the second language there is English. So a country, you know, most countries, you know, have a lot of English speakers, and you have to be creative and hire interpreters. So these things can be done. You know, again, I'm an advocate of increasing the size of the military. You know, 100,000 is great, and they indicated that they're going to do somewhat close to that. That is a very good thing. You know, I think we have lost a lot of political clout because of the progress or lack thereof in Iraq. However, we still are finding that when, you know, countries like Iran creep up, our allies come out of the Middle East, come out of the woodwork. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and Egypt are very concerned about Persian dominance of the Gulf region. So we still have allies out there. We just need to conduct careful diplomacy and recultivate these ties. I think that it's possible, because in the end, our allies realize that the alternative to American dominance of the region is not as good.
Oh, absolutely, Bill. And I have to say, again, it's a standard operating procedure around here as we close with the folks that we're interviewing here. Give them a chance to plug away. Of course, you not only have your very excellent website, BillRaggio.com. Of course, you're an assistant editor with the counterterrorism blog. I know that there are opportunities for very loyal and appreciative readers to underwrite trips such as this one to Iraq. So please, by all means, anything out there that you'd like our audience to be aware of.
Sure. Yeah, what I've done, just so you're aware, is I've created a nonprofit media organization in order to facilitate my embeds. Any donations to my organization will be tax deductible once the paperwork is cleared for the for federal nonprofit status. So, you know, I'm trying to work as many embeds as I can personally, as well as sponsor other embeds. I have a couple of people in the pipeline to embed, and it's a very expensive venture. Life insurance is a great expense, communications, travel. So if you do appreciate independent journalism, you know, that's free of the politics that you'll read in the Associated Press or Reuters or the New York Times. I don't talk politics, and I don't we discuss the issues that face our soldiers, the issues that are facing us in a global war. And just another organization I certainly would like to plug, just an organization I've been working with, is called Spirit of America. It's a wonderful organization. Again, you know, nonpartisan, non-political. They just work to get supplies out to the American troops, as well as, you know, to help them with local projects, civil affairs type projects like rebuilding schools and any other technology that is needed out there. And it really bypasses a lot of the bureaucracy that exists in the national level. I think, you know, our State Department has really failed state commerce, all of our civilian agencies have really failed in backing this effort. And groups like Spirit of America, and that's a, I think it's spiritofamerica.net, is, you can hit their address there. It is a great organization that's a very, is willing to fill that goal, and I've done some work for them. I'm very appreciative of what they do.
Oh, very good stuff, Bill, and very good stuff having you on tonight. We really look forward to having you on, and it was just awesome. Can't thank you enough, and we'd be very honored if we could get you back on at some point in the future and catch up with hopefully things continuing to go better against the jihad.
I hope so as well, and yes, absolutely. Anytime you're interested, give me a call, and I'll be more than happy to join you. Appreciate an intelligent discussion, you know, on I think the most important issue facing this nation since its founding.
Yes, it most definitely is. We thank you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks. Bill Raggio, BillRaggio.com, BillRaggio.com. And gentlemen, that was very good.
Without a doubt, and I think that's the kind of thing that what we're trying to do with this radio show is to bring a little bit of variety to the listeners. Yeah, we can talk about you know, the Pistons' power forward situation, and then we can turn around and we can talk about a serious subject like the war in Iraq and how that is related to international terrorism. And a guest like Bill Raggio is just fantastic.
And to show you that I have a sense of what did and didn't belong in that interview there, I'm going to note this before we go to break. In the Philippines, apparently the Muslim separatist group has the acronym MILF, M-I-L-F. Didn't seem appropriate to mention there.
I'm glad you went ahead and left that alone.
Little something the listeners should know, but I didn't think we should trouble Bill with that, so I actually got that off of his blog.
Luckily, we suppressed the sophomoreish angle of this show just long enough to get Bill's interview
done. I continue to amaze and surprise people, including my longtime friends.